Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe. And Connor, you weren't here last week.
No, I was not.
We ran a bit of a repeat on the show. It was the piece about the beauty of language, or the judgment, finding a language beautiful, but also what is a wise person. You remember that interview?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We got two emails about wisdom. The first one here is from Melora from Central Florida. I'm not sure if she's ever written in.
Melora?
Melora.
No, I don't. Or at least I don't recognize that
name. Subject
of
the email, wise. Widowed at 26, less than 5 months married, made me a, quote, sadder but wiser girl. And in parentheses, credit to the musical The Music Man. I had to look into myself to comprehend the experience of life, death, loss. I had to figure out who I was, who I wanted to be, and how I wanted to live in the world, in a way that I probably would not have had the foresight to do if life had gone as planned. I am now 57 and very often feel stunted like that 26-year-old, but have made a good life for myself, and I do feel wise.
Thank you.
Wow.
Melora, the only question I have there was the reference to a Music Man.
I've never heard that. The Music Man. Is that a musical, I guess?
I guess.
Does anybody know that musical? Did it have a profound impact on you? Let us know about it.
Is it a musical?
That's what she says. Credit the musical, The Music Man.
Oh, okay. I missed that. Okay. Yeah, I don't know that musical.
Mm-hmm. But there's one more about wisdom here. And then you've got an email that you have not read yet. But
correct.
Hold on.
Correct.
Hello, Connor and Abe.
Oh, that makes you sound so much older and wiser. Speaking of wisdom.
I was listening to your podcast regarding what is wisdom, and what I think wisdom is putting into practice life experiences and knowing what the right thing is to do in circumstances that arise by listening, watching, reading, reenacting, discovering, losing, persevering. We all become more understanding, sympathetic, and empathetic people. Thank you from Cindy.
Thank you,
Thank
Cindy.
You. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of aspects to wisdom. I recall during that interview, I didn't listen to the rebroadcasted version of it, but that one of your questions was something along the lines of whether somebody who thinks they're wise can possibly be wise. Probably not. If you think you're unwise, that probably makes you wiser. One of the paradoxes of that topic.
This is on the second topic. You have not read this email. Read it through. It's a goodie.
You printed it and you ripped it off to give to me, and you ripped it right through the middle of a line. So
well,
I'll
you
try
just
to
read
it.
Yeah, okay.
The first opera I saw as a young man was The Magic Flute. I found the spoken part so beautiful that German became my favorite language. I agree with your German listener that your program shows English speech at its best. In the case of Connor, it is a matter of enunciation and personality. With Gabe, it is sheer beauty of tone. The voice makes me see Gabe as a handsome young man with light-colored curly hair and nicely rounded cheeks and body. All that from your voice.
Do you remember that in that there, we got an email about a year ago? There was a woman, a German woman from an island up in the Baltic
yes.
Sea, who, whenever she hears your voice, feels Feuer und Flamme.
Fire and flames.
Fire and flames, because she was astounded by the beauty of your voice. I've got my own little fan here.
That makes us happy to hear these things. Gabe's hair is straight. I happen to have the curlier hair, but otherwise I would absolutely agree with the nicely rounded cheeks and body. Very nice body, Gabe. Or Abe. So, on to the studies. We have one that is sort of connected to, or is connected to, current events right now, but is actually an interview that we did a while back. Many of you are aware of the fact that Pope Francis, the head of the Catholic Church, the Pontificate, passed away on April 21st, and that right now we're in the beginning of a process where the Catholic Church, on behalf of its 1.4 billion adherents, is electing a new pope from amongst the cardinals. That's what's happening now. The time frames are all kind of wishy-washy, but sometime in May, we're probably going to find out. The reason I bring that up is because often here on DWTV or on the news, when you're watching it, they talk about the pope as a moral compass.
Well, right now, the moral compass is missing.
Right.
Until that new pontificate is elected.
Right.
There's no moral compass.
You could think
for
that.
For the billion Catholics.
For them. Absolutely right. For the
1.4
billion.
I'm sure that's the way they feel.
The moral compass is gone. And I just want to remind our listeners, and or some of you wouldn't have heard this interview back when we did it. This is more than a year ago on exactly this subject. Do you need religion to have a moral compass? And if you wanted to answer that question, how on earth would you go about doing it? I'm just going to go ahead and go straight to the researcher herself. This is Madeline Reinicke. She was at the time, I think she still is, at the University of Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to give you the conclusion of her study on two groups of small children.
The primary conclusion is that in both ages of kids we tested, so that was 4 to 6 year olds and 7 to 9 year olds, we see that they tend to think that morality couldn't be changed by God, that widely shared aspects of morality, they think that those things have to be the way that they are, that they couldn't be changed even by an omnipotent entity.
And I'm just going to jump in and add a qualifier or just a clarification. How do you test that with small children, 4 to 6 year olds and 7 to 9 year olds? You ask them specifically, this is one of the examples, if you step or if a kid steps on another kid's foot, is that, and it's like stomps it, hurts it, is that okay or is it not okay? And usually the kid's like, no.
All of them said that. Yeah, you don't, that's not okay.
That's not okay. You don't do that. Yeah. And then they pose this theoretical question. Well, what if God said it was okay, that you should do that? In fact, it's good to stomp another kid's foot. Then the children, already by age 4 and all the way up until the upper limit, 9, were fully okay already with basically saying, nah, God's wrong there. If you're interested in listening to the whole interview with Madeline Reinicke on our website or on podcast platforms, wherever you listen to us normally, it's called Kids Don't Need God to Tell Them What's Right or Wrong. We originally broadcast that interview back in January of 2024. And you can go back and take a look into the study itself. It's in the journal Cognitive Development called Children Deny That God Could Change Morality.
We are going to stick with the concept of God, given the gigantic, you know, peg, the pontiff.
Well, it's
dead.
One of the big, look, on this show.
When you look back to this week, what is the world going to remember?
It's, yeah. That's
the death of the Pope.
This is a big news story, and it's the realm of religion is not really for a science podcast to touch or radio show to touch, usually.
But when studies are done on religion, why not? Based on the findings of this study that I'm going to discuss now, it might look like we're ganging up on religion here. We're not at all. If you're listening to this right now, you want to weigh in on the concept of morality or forgiveness, what we're going to talk about in a bit, please do. This study is out of the University of Pittsburgh. They were looking at 435 participants, each of them of a different background, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish mm-hmm. backgrounds. And what they wanted to do was have these people remember a time where they hurt or offended someone. And there was no reconciliation. So that conflict happened, and it was never solved.
I'm trying to think of a time where I did that. I know I've done that.
Think about it right now. When's the last time you hurt someone? You know you did. And then you never solved it. You never asked for forgiveness or apologized.
I'm married, so this is probably a near daily. Okay. If you were to ask my wife, okay. Right, I'm not trying to. But
just
yeah.
Think about the offense.
Yeah.
Right? Please.
Okay.
Questionnaire. To what extent has God forgiven you for this offense? You think about that.
Can I answer it?
No. How likely is it that you will apologize for the offense? Think about those two questions. And then these participants, these 435 participants, were instructed to write an email to the victim apologizing for that offense.
That's a nice task, even if you don't ever send that email.
Mm-hmm. What the researchers at Pittsburgh found out was that the more people felt that God had forgiven them. So to question one, if they said that, yeah, I feel like God forgave me, even though I never solved the conflict myself or did anything about it, I feel that God forgave me. The less likely it would be that they would reach out to that person and apologize. If God forgave me, that means that those people, it's less likely that they're going to reach out. And the sincerity of, remember they wrote the email as well. The sincerity of that text was analyzed. The people who thought God had forgiven them or felt that God had forgiven them, they weren't as nice or genuine in their apology than the people who didn't feel that God had forgiven them.
You don't have to put the effort in. you don't need to be forgiven by this mortal human who him or herself or themselves is a sinner and a problematic individual if the highest possible power has already forgiven you.
I'm absolved.
Yeah.
I don't have to do anything about it. It's all gravy.
I grew up going to a Catholic church on Sundays, and our church did not have a confession booth. Didn't have one at all.
Even though it was a Catholic church?
Yes. No confession booth at all. And later, I remember thinking that was probably a good thing, because I find that a bit problematic if you're just sort of saying I did this and then getting forgiveness and walking out and it's all taken care of. No, as this study shows, humans are messy and it's hard to go up and say, I messed up, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And again, we're not ganging up on the Catholic faith. Literally, this study looked at, you know, Jews, Muslims, and Christians. They all do this. If you want to look into it, it's implications of divine forgiveness for conciliatory behavior, understanding how feeling forgiven by God influences apologies via self-forgiveness, gratitude, and humility.
Yeah, and I think the concrete lesson for our religious listeners out there, you may need to work harder remind yourself to go out and really deeply apologize to the person.
It will make it less likely that you do. Keep that, be aware of it. Just keep that in mind.
Yeah. Last study that we'll look into here, this one comes from the Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences in Leipzig, Germany. We talked about them a few weeks back with regard to dyslexia. Mm-hmm. They took a really powerful MRI tool, looked in the brain, and discovered which substructures of the human thalamus were connected with, linked to dyslexia, typically in men in that case. This is the same institute, the same place, looking at not the deepest part of the human brain, but the kind of outside of the human brain, the cerebrum. And to make this a little easier to understand, just imagine a walnut. I think most of you are familiar with it. When you crack open a walnut shell and you're looking at that walnut, you've got these two hemispheres. And now imagine you're looking at that walnut, and mostly toward the front of the walnut, the anterior of the walnut, you've got these white little splotches. I'd probably eat that walnut anyway, but it might be a sign to you, like, something's not quite right with this walnut.
Yeah, you want a perfect walnut, yeah.
Usually, yeah. So what these white splotches are, the actual technical definition for them, these are white matter hyperintensities. I don't like that. It's too hard to say. So I'm going to call them white blobs from here on out. Mm-hmm. These are lesions on your brain that develop over time. You can only start seeing them from the age of 40 onwards with an MRI. And as the word lesions suggests, they are not good. These are what cause people, or they're one of the factors that cause people as they age to process information more slowly.
Okay.
So you know when you're like, you're searching for a word or trying to do a math problem that you used to be able to do or find that crossword solution? It might be one of these.
Could be. Okay. Yeah.
It could be. Yep. Yeah. One of these white blobs.
Yeah.
It's also strongly linked to dementia later in life.
Yeah.
Also, depending on where it's located in your brain, very strongly connected to the risk of stroke. So ischemic strokes, that's when a clot blocks off the blood supply, right? And some of the cells die off. Or also hemorrhagic, so one of the blood vessels bursts and now you've got all this pressure on your brain. None of this stuff is good. It all may come from one of these white blobs or white matter hyperintensities. So where do those come from? Because we have no solution for this. That was part of the point of this study, is let's figure out exactly where they are and which patterns they kind of crop up in so that we can start talking about how to treat them hopefully in the future.
At this point, we have no idea what to do about these blobs.
No. So it's all about prevention. The biggest factor, if you're worried about this yourself, if you think, my brain's slowing down with time, maybe I have this. The biggest factor is whether or not you have high blood pressure. And to keep things simple, I'm just going to end this with a concrete set of tips based on this paper and the medical advice connected to this paper.
How to bring blood pressure down?
Blood pressure down, but how to improve, because it's also connected to body mass index, so your weight. It's all sorts of lifestyle factors.
Yeah.
This is going to sound, you've heard this before. I'm just going to say it
again. Doesn't matter, say it, yeah.
To stay healthy and to keep your brain healthy, if that's important to you, because it's not important to everyone, move your body. That's probably the most important thing you can do right now today to keep your brain healthy. Move your body around. Doesn't really matter how. Just do it with your own power.
Yeah, and if you don't do it at all, start small.
Start small.
Couple minutes.
Yeah.
Just get out. Get outside. Go back in. Yeah.
Next, you've heard this before. Eat more healthy food.
What does that mean?
Eat healthier food. Your doctor has probably said this to you 15 times. I'm going to just mention what has happened to work for me. It's two specific, really specific things. It's that when I'm hungry and I see a bag of potato chips or tortilla chips, which are delicious.
Finish the whole thing.
Don't even open the bag. Replace those with nuts, with salty nuts. A lot of times, I think it's the salt that I want. And then I can, and if it's the right kind of, it doesn't always work. And sometimes I go back to the chips, but it's a start. Same thing with chocolate or candy. If you want something sweet, at some point I heard the tip that try a piece of fruit first, and then you can go to the candy. That has personally helped me out. Smoking, Gabe, we've talked about this on the show. That's a bad thing in connection with these white blobs in your brain.
Yeah.
Try to reduce. I think that's a start. And finally, alcohol, same thing for a lot of you out there. I love a good drink, especially in company, but try to reduce. You will improve your cognition over time. If you want to look into how exactly they did this study, I didn't even get into the methodology. It was 3,000 people over the age of 65, either in Germany or France. That's the data set. That's what they looked at to establish this. It's called White Matter Hyperintensity Spatial Patterns, Risk Factors, and Clinical Correlates, and it was published in Alzheimer's and Dementia, the Journal of the Alzheimer's Association. That one, by the way, is not paywalled. Anyone can look at it.
And now we're going to listen to some music.
Oh, my gosh. I would have forgotten that.
Yeah. We're going to listen to a piece of music here, and we want you to feel. What do you feel when you listen to this music?
Yeah, and a very important piece of information and special thanks to our studio technician, Christian Steta. We were walking out of a studio yesterday, and he mentioned as an aside that he makes music and that it's available on Spotify. If later you decide that you like this next song and you want more of this music, email us, su@dw.com. I don't think I'm allowed to give him free promotion here. But I will happily send you a link to his stuff online. But like Gabe said, for now, just try to focus on what you feel when you listen to this music.
Dir doch mal für zwei Minuten bequem. Ich hoffe, der Sound ist locker und die Raps sind gut zu verstehen. Setz dich am besten hin, mein Freund, du kannst doch ruhig noch einen drehen. Genieß die Tracks, hör ganz genau hin und versuch es zu sehen. Ich geb's euch doch bildlich gesprochen, weiß ihr checkt, dass darin Liebe steckt. Hab mir mein Ziel gesteckt, dass ich's erreich, will ich mal hoffen. Diese Scheibe soll ein Anfang sein. Mehr als der Standard-Scheiß, den ihr anderen reißt. Ich machte fast alles ganz allein, auf Wähler fangen wir an Parteien. Bin ich durchs Land gereist, bei Sessions angeheizt. Die Stadt im Schweiß, als wär's Zwangsarbeit. Zwei Mann am Mic, manchmal drei, die einen Standpunkt teilen. Je nach Programm und Zeit, dieses auch ab und zu mal Wandanschreiner, Beats gebaut in Handarbeit. Muss ich erst Platten liegen, 5 Uhr raus zum Flohmarkt. Frühstück gab's nicht, nur eine Schachtel kippen. Später die Sachen mischen, blieb lange im Schatten sitzen. Aus Massenskizzen Texte schreiben, auch bei Affenhitze. Komm raus ans Licht und genieße jeden Augenblick. Lebe jetzt und pack in jeden Text, was in meinem Schädel wächst. CRS, der von der Seele rappt. Also lass mich erzählen, nimm dir noch etwas Zeit, hör zu und mach's dir bequem.
Hi, my name is Giacomo Bignardi, short is Giaco, and I'm a doctoral student at the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics, where I'm studying music, genetics, and art. And together with a group of co-workers at the Max Planck Institute for Empirical Aesthetics, I just published a paper in Nature Communication on music, genetics, and pleasure.
Giaco, if you had to choose one chief finding from this paper that you and your colleagues just published, what is it exactly? What did you find?
The capacity to experience pleasure from music is heritable. This is number one. The second thing is that genetic effects that can explain variability in experienced pleasure from music are partially independent from the ability to perceive music and to feel pleasure in general. And three, that there might be mostly distinct genetic effects to different facets on the ways people experience music.
And when you say heritable, what you're saying there is that if my ability to feel pleasure when I listen to music, let's say I'm riding the car, great song comes on, and I'm on cloud nine, that feeling in me is inherited from one or both of my parents, or what do you mean there?
So with heritability, unfortunately, it's like a concept that people tend to misunderstand all the time, but it's simply like, it's just like a statistical concept. It's just a number. It's the percentage of variability that you can explain in a given population at a given time in a certain trait. So for our study, we just put a number. 54% of the variability can be explained by genetic differences between people in the ability to perceive music.
How did you come up with that that specific number, 54? What did you do in your study? How did you conduct it?
So the idea was to exploit the similarity between identical twins and non-identical twins. Identical twin shares all of their genes, while non-identical twin shares about half. And we simply ask people the way they experience music, and we observe that identical twins were much more similar than non-identical twins, more than double, actually. And we use a statistical model to recover that particular number.
I know this isn't the point of your study, but now I'm kind of surprised or interested in the fact that identical twins who have the same genetic information inside their bodies, that they would experience music differently. You must have seen that in the study then, that two people, two very, very, very similar people, then didn't react with as much pleasure to the same music?
Yeah, so it would be very interesting to look at the experience of identical twins to the same music. We just asked questions about how they, in general, interact with music. So questions, for example, whether they get chills from music sometimes, or even if they like to dance along with a beat, or things like that. And identical twins were much more similar in the way they were interacting with music, but non-identical. There were still like some uniqueness on average, even in identical twins. So there is some genetic influence on the trait, but there is also something that is unique to each of us.
And with regard to that unique to each of us, how exactly do or why do we feel pleasure when we listen to music? What happens inside our brain that makes us feel that feeling of pleasure when we hear music?
Yeah, this is the great question, right? The one that we would really like to answer. So some of our colleagues in the past described this condition. I don't know if you know about it. It's called musical anhedonia. So there are certain individuals that cannot experience pleasure from music, but they can experience pleasure virtually from everything else. And when they did neuroimaging studies, they found out that this individual had reduced connectivity between auditory cortices and reward-related regions in the brain. So the idea is that when we experience music, or when people cannot experience pleasure from music, there is a sort of disconnectivity between areas that make music a possible percept and areas that attribute value to that perception.
That connectivity that you were talking about, can it be changed? Or is there something that we can do to manipulate it or change it so that, I don't know, people who don't experience music as, or pleasure from music as much as others, could someday experience it that way?
This is a great question, one that I don't have an answer for, but since we're talking about this concept of genes, irritability, connectivity, changes, irritability doesn't mean immutable. Actually, something that is heritable can be still quite malleable. So the idea that our genetic effects do not imply that these things are fixed nor are wired. People developed in different environments and they have the genetic predisposition, and this might interact with the environment they live in, and then this might influence the way these areas of the brain get connected through development. It's a lot of an answer question, to be honest.
We've been talking at this point about musical anhedonia. Anhedonia being the inability to feel pleasure. Is there something, I'm just realizing this or thinking about it now, is there something or such thing as musical hyperhedonia? A person who, when music comes on, is overpowered by pleasure, almost pathologically, possibly? Like, does it go that far? Somebody who's wildly euphoric in a life-disrupting way because of music?
I would say definitely yes. So Oliver Sacks was talking about this in musicophilia, and Robert Zatorre and colleagues, I think, in some of their works, described hyperhedonia, so they divided groups in anhedonic, like normal hedonic, and sometimes hyperhedonic. And if I looked at my data, for example, we had this questionnaire and the maximum score was 100. And note that some of the items were reverse scored. So people would have need to answer 1 to get 5. So it's not people that were just like ticking the boxes at the max. And certain people scored 100. So there were people that were definitely like on all aspects of music enjoyment, like very much enjoying music.
I'm imagining somebody, like they walk by a speaker box and it's playing the right kind of music and they almost melt, like they drop to the ground in pleasure. Does that kind of hyperhedonia exist?
I don't know. It would be in this modern world, it would be quite hard, I think, to live and go around with a certain condition. But I mean, it's variability, right? And when you're talking about variability as a spectrum, you will have people at the end of both spectrums. So these people might exist.
And that was Giacomo Bignardi speaking to us from Galatina, Italy. And you know how Italy is that boot, right? He is right now on the heel of that boot.
In the middle of the heel.
In the middle of the heel.
Yeah. And he said...
At his parents' place down there.
Yeah. That right now things are calm there, despite a lot of action in the rest of Italy, or in, at least in Rome. Calm and sunny.
Yeah.
The kind of temperatures that make us a little bit envious here in Bonn, Germany, at the moment where the rain is pouring down. But that is neither here nor there. The reason I asked about hyperhedonia with connection to music, I was thinking of you, Gabe, because I think on the spectrum of hedonias... Or the ability to feel pleasure for anything, but in this case, music, you would be on the hyper side of things when it comes to music?
I'm not sure always. Like, you described that situation of walking past a music box and just melting down. I don't have that. But at least once a day, I put my headphones on and play Bob Marley, some reggae music, and I take my Dalmatian dog up into the forest. We've got the forest is about 10 minutes away, and once I get underneath those towering beech trees with my dog running off the leash and Marley hits my ears, I start almost jumping, like galloping, looking up to these towering beech trees with my hands up in the air. I can feel the music, like light entering my body, and yeah, that is absolute pleasure. I am describing to you an absolutely pure source of pleasure for me. I genuinely wonder whether other people, if they see what's happening, whether they would find that abnormal, or whether other people, given the right set of circumstances and genes, whether that would be normal behavior.
I think it's just
what's happening.
Germans would find your behavior highly inappropriate in the quietude of a German Wald or forest, and then this maniac jumping around with his noise-canceling headphones and singing Marley with a Dalmatian at his side, you're going to get the police called on you. Although maybe you can then tell the police, no, I have musical hyperhedonia as a result.
It's just the connectivity, the auditory connectivity inside my brain, Herr Offizier.
Anyway, how do you feel? How do you experience musical pleasure the way Gabe does, or is it more neutral for you, or are you one of the people who really doesn't? I mean, what's interesting is we were talking not about an inability to understand or care for music at all. It's just about feeling pleasure for it, so you can intellectually understand it and appreciate it. Do you feel pleasure when you hear it?
Or do you know any twins that feel different levels of pleasure? Can you weigh on that debate? Because I found that really fascinating.
Yeah.
Either way, let us know at su@dw.com. And thank you guys for listening.
DW. Made for Minds.